If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool, along with Racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens. Hire Hensley. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson here as well. Lathan Kuhn's putting it all together. And for those of you who comment, and we appreciate it, on how much you enjoy Beyond the Bricks, the heavy lifting is absolutely done by Mike Thompson, who sifts through his vast catalog of audio to come up with different clips and different historical factoids, puts it all together, and then Landon puts together and glues the jigsaw puzzle that becomes Beyond the Bricks. So it is greatly appreciated, the work that both of them do. And tonight, we're going to actually, I know that Mike Thompson's favorite one-hit wonder, as it's listed, is the Safety Dance by Men Without Hats. That's a two-hit wonder, by the way, because they had Pop Goes the World as well. Mine would probably be Dexy's Midnight Runner with Come On Eileen. But Mike, reality is this. There have been 804 drivers that have been credited with qualifying to start the Indianapolis 500, but nearly a third of those we would list as one-hit wonders, and we're going to talk about that tonight.
Yeah, that's right. I was actually pretty surprised by that stat. There, with the 804 different people who are credited as starting drivers, more than 250 of them had only one start, and that really surprised me. So I thought it'd be kind of fun tonight if we looked at some of the drivers, and obviously there are various reasons why. Some of the people, they did it once, and honestly, they didn't enjoy it and didn't come back. And some of them had, you know, tragic situations like a Jim Hickman, who we'll talk about later.
Ray Haroon was one of those that was one in done, but he made the most of that start in 1911. Of course, he did have relief help for 35 laps, but he won the first installment of the International Sweepstakes Indianapolis 500. Donald Davidson, the Speedway historian emeritus on Ray Haroon.
Anyway, Ray Haroon did run a number of the races because he was contracted with Marmon, Nordyke and Marmon. He was an engineer as well as one of their drivers, and the main event that he won was, in fact, this is the only one that I can actually say for sure, because he did win several events. And to clarify a little bit about why I'm a little hazy on this, is that they would run a lot of races. And a typical program, a three-day program, normally maybe 8 to 10 races in a day, and they would be a series of short sprints. Two-lap standing dashes and four-lap standing dashes for different classifications of passenger car with a longer race at the end of the day. So you might have 24 events over a three-day period. And Ray Haroon won several of those. The main one that he won was the 200-mile Wheeler-Shevler race on May 30th of 1910. So exactly 365 days, unless it was a leap year there, before winning the first 500, he won a 200-mile race at the Speedway on the bricks. And maybe this is an opportunity to bring up that there's a lot of myths out there, and one of these days I'm going to give up trying to dispel them, but I haven't given up yet. And there's one that's going around all over the place now about the fact that Ray Haroon went to the Firestone engineers on the eve of the 1911 500 and said to the engineers, "What speed do I need to run in order to get the best wear out of my tires?" Baloney! He'd already worked that out well in advance, probably when running the 200-mile race in 1910. But if you read Al Blemker's book, and I talked to Ray Haroon in my early years at the track, And they actually, he figured that out himself. The engineers worked that out. I don't think they went to Firestone at all. I think that Haroon thought, you can go out and blow a tire, so let me do a little tire testing here. And he figured out that while he could run 80 miles an hour and above, if he ran 75 miles an hour, he could double his tire wear. So I think that's probably in the movie script, and I've seen it in a media guide, about that apparently Haroon went to the engineers the night before the 1911 race. Nonsense. They had that worked out well in advance, and as I say, probably with the experience of running in the 1910 200-mile race, because obviously, just as fuel consumption is a factor now, so tire wear was then. And if you're going to go fast and blow your tires, well, then don't run as fast, and you can do better. And it's surprising that that hadn't happened at another event that was held at the track a few years ago. But anyway, I won't go into that right now. I think that Ray Haroon, I'm just guessing this, he may have won like maybe five or six events. They weren't all in the Marmon Wasp. So some of them were in stock Marmons. I think the record for most wins by any driver in 9 and 10 was Johnny Aitken, and I think he won like 14 races or something like that.
One of the most famous photographs of the era in which Ray Haroon would win that inaugural Indianapolis 500 is that, of course, of Lewis Strang standing next to a model of what would become the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, standing in an area essentially that is just outside of turn number 2 of the speedway, overlooking all of it in the grass. He was the pole sitter for the 500 that first year, but lost his life later in the same year, but not in a race car. Donald Davidson with that sad story.
What happened? It was a reliability run. He was driving for Case, who had 3 cars in the 1911 race, and it was the J.I. Case Thrashing Machine Company from Racine, Wisconsin, but they built automobiles, and he was testing one on an open street, open road somewhere. July 20th or 19th, apparently he went into a ditch and it rolled and threw him out. It was a passenger car, not a race car.
Oh boy. Well, he had a pretty good record as a driver.
Yeah, he was a couple of pieces of trivia about him. Number one is he was the nephew of Walter Christie, of the Christie front drive
I
fame.
Know him, yes.
And then also there is a photograph, a frequently seen photograph of a miniature of the Indianapolis Speedway on the ground out in front of where the track was built. It's a miniature of the track so that people driving by could see what they were building. And there's a fellow standing there with a pork pie hat, and he is frequently captioned as being Carl Fisher, and it's not Carl Fisher, it's Lewis Strang.
I know exactly what you're saying. I've got it on my web.
Yeah, and why he would be, why they would have had him for the shot, I have no idea, because this was before they even knew they were going to have a 500. It was while the track was being built is when they put that out there on what was then Crawfordsville Pike and what is now 16th Street.
It really is interesting, Jake, that Strang is the person in that photograph, that famous photograph that's known as the Vision, because as Donald mentions, that photograph was taken before there ever was going to be a 500-mile race. People didn't know he was going to be the first pole sitter, and the way the pole was decided in those days was solely on when you turned your entry blank in. So if you turned your entry blank in first, not only did you get to start first, but you were car number one. So if you turned your entry in 32nd, as the Marmon Company did, because they specifically wanted to be number 32 because they had the Type 32 car, you were number 32, but you also started in that spot, basically. So it's an interesting situation that Strang happens to be that person in that famous photograph, and he happens to be the person who was the pole sitter for the first Indianapolis 500.
If you had to guess, Mike, who would you say is the person that is most commonly thought to be that, the photo of Lewis Strang standing with his hands on his knees overlooking the Vision, who do you think is the person that most people, when they see that photograph, assume is the subject of the photo?
Oh, I think everybody thinks it's Carl Fisher.
Correct.
You know, who is really the, you know, the catalyst for why we're even talking right now. Carl Fisher, you know, is the person who is the driving force. And that's probably a bad pun, but really the driving force, the catalyst behind the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the getting it built. So I think a lot of people think the person in that picture is Carl Fisher. But it is obviously Lewis Strang.
Now, if we're going to stay within the era of the pre-war, so to speak, let's move along now to another driver, and that would be Alfred Moss, who raced in 1924, only one race in the Indianapolis 500-mile race. And you may be saying to yourself, Moss is a familiar name within racing. Well, that's correct, not just because of Alfred driving in the 1924 race, but also because his son, the great Sterling Moss, is perhaps the greatest driver not to win the World Driving Championship. Donald Davidson on Alfred Moss.
Yes, he was Sterling Moss's father, so that's the kind of trivia that the great Sterling Moss, probably the greatest Grand Prix driver who never won the world championship, and some people say the greatest Grand Prix driver anyway, some right. people say that, never participated at Indianapolis, but his father did in 24 and 25.
Oh, he was in it 2 years.
Yes, he was actually a relief driver in 25, and he was a dental student. And just in Indianapolis. And he had run some events in England, not a great deal, but he had run at Brooklands in lesser events. And he came in and kind of talked his way into the Chevrolet brothers. Actually, he was supposed to drive a Mercedes that had crashed the year before and was privately owned. That's what he was going to drive. And then he got hooked in with Arthur Chevrolet and drove one of the Barbara Warnock 24s.
Mike, just out of curiosity, during your childhood, or maybe even to today, did you enjoy some Brock's Hard Candy when you'd be at the grocery store?
Yes. I like those, you know, those caramels. Didn't they make the caramels?
Yeah, they do.
You know,
yes,
the little,
indeed.
Yeah.
I'm a
the
fan
little
of
caramels
the
that came
discs.
In the wrapping.
Yeah. Of course, the cinnamon discs, also a favorite. Not spelled the same, not B-R-A-C-H, but rather B-R-O-C-K. S.F. Brock, you may not be familiar. He raced in 1914. He was unfortunately lost at sea in a submarine in 1918 during World War I, but he did make that Indianapolis 500 start. Donald Davidson on SF Brock.
Okay, 1914, he drove a car called the Ray. And this is a bit of a mystery character, because the early reports were that he was from Indianapolis, but in fact I think he was from Portland, Oregon, and he entered this car called the Ray, which I think was basically Mercer parts, if not a complete Mercer. But he brought it to the city early and found a garage somewhere near downtown and prepped it for the 1914 race, qualified, and was the first one out. And then the mystery about him, and I've had several people work on this, and maybe someday we'll get the answer. His name is listed in the 1919 program. They have like a memorial page with people who lost their lives during World War I. And one of them is S.F. Brock, and it says that he is something that he's lost in a submarine disaster off the coast of England in 1918. And I've done quite a bit of research, and several other people have as well, and we have not yet been able to identify what the submarine was. Maybe one day somebody will have the answer.
Now, Mike, occasionally we come across or we know of drivers that beyond their driving career became very important within the rules and regulation of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway or the Indianapolis 500, maybe to the point where people may have forgotten the fact that they made a 500 start.
Yeah, that's a lot of times that's the case. People may know of Harry McQuinn, a guy like that, who he was an official later on in life. And Harlan Fengler is probably the best known example of that, who we're going to talk about next. Fengler was a really good driver. And I think people forget the fact that he was a very, very good driver. He won a couple of championship races. And I don't think people really remember the fact that he had a really good driving career before he became the chief steward.
That driving career was a start in 1923 in the Indianapolis 500. He only turned in 69 laps before basically a fuel tank issue would drop him out of the race. He would finish in 16th position. That was three spots higher, though, than where he started. Here's Donald Davidson.
They called him the wonder boy of the board tracks. In fact, when you said Atlantic City, I thought you were going to ask about the board track that was there. But and Harlan Fengler probably drove at that one. I'm not sure, but he did have success on board tracks like Beverly Hills, and he was very young. They called him the wonder boy, as I say. And in 1922, he was a riding mechanic for Harry Hart, so that shows how far back they went. When Harry Hart finished second in the 1922 500, Harlan Fengler was the riding mechanic. And I think he was, I don't think he was 21 years old yet. In fact, he might have been 19. And then in 1923, he was part of Cliff Durant's team of Millers in the 500. And as you say, that he was a one-time starter. He didn't finish that one. In 24, he was there with a car, the Wade Special, a Miller, but he got that one upside down. And he was also entered in 26, but I don't think he drove. But he was an engineer. And apparently, he had something to do with a company called Craigar. And whether he founded that or he owned it at one time, but he never married. He knew several film stars, and famously Loretta Young. He knew Loretta Young when she was like about 12 or 13 years old, and her older sister, and used to go and have tea with the mother and the two daughters. And in fact, he and Loretta Young actually kept in contact, you know, all the way through and until, you know, around the time that he passed away. He lived in Dayton for quite a while. Well, actually, knew Lebanon, which is just outside of Dayton, and he worked for Ford Motor Company and as an engineer. And I think, but it was Ford Motor Company, but with an aircraft involvement, but I'm a little hazy on that. He was the promoter at the Dayton Speedway for a short time, and had become an official at the Speedway in probably, and I'm going to have to guess, that's probably 49-50. He was a referee. And then when Harry McQuinn, who was the chief steward from 53 to 57, he actually stepped down under pressure, and I'm not really quite sure what that was all about, but he did step down. And in 1958, then Harlan Fengler was named the chief steward to succeed Harry McQuinn, and then Fengler was the chief steward all the way until 1973, and he died, oh golly, I don't remember exactly what year now, but it was probably around 79-80. It wasn't too long after he'd given up the chief stewardship.
Now, Mike, this next clip has a couple of things in common with you. A caller named Mike, the state of Ohio, and the discussion of Art Bish, correct?
That's correct. And so I was fortunate enough a few times before I moved to Indiana to call into the Talk of Gasoline Alley and get on the air. And I think that's actually was, you know, you think about it now about how cool it was to sit on the phone and you're sitting there holding and you're like, am I going to get on the air? And you know, that anticipation and Scott Johnston at the time. And, you know, he's still there. He was, you know, running the board and, you know, okay, what do you want to talk about, and screening the calls. And it was really exciting for me. I was living in Grandview Heights, Ohio at the time, and I got on the air to ask about, I always wanted to ask about somebody obscure, so I asked about Art Bish on this particular call.
Art Bish, he finished, he's one of, I think there's like about 12 or 13 people that finished last in their only start, except that his completed no laps. He was from Phoenix, Arizona. And I'll tell you about the 500 career first, and then go back, and then, because you're going to say, well, who is this guy? Well, I can tell you just a little. I can tell you a little bit about him, because he was a fairly accomplished driver. In 1958 was the first year that he was here, and he got into a car that was owned by Jack Ensley. And for people that have followed this for quite some time, it was a fairly well-known car, because Pat O'Connor had driven it in 55 and 56 as the Anstead Rotary Special, and then Don Freeland drove it in 57. Well, in 58, Anstead had sold it to Jack Ensley. Jack Ensley took his rookie test in it. He was an SCCA driver who lived locally and was quite well-known, had a nightclub called the Jaguar Room. Anyway, it's got nothing to do with Art Bish, except that when Jack Ensley decided to step out of the car after he had passed his test, they put Art Bish in it. Bish passed his test, qualified the car, got bumped,
And then on the final day, he got into another car called the Helsey Special that was owned by Herb and Elsie Johnson, and that's where the name Helsey came from. Bruce Crower was the chief mechanic, and Art Bish was a late qualifier, started in the back, and then on the first lap, in the third turn of the first lap, there was this huge accident developed that ended up taking the life of Pat O'Connor, and a number of, I think, seven or eight cars were eliminated, one of them being Art Bish. And in the event of cars being eliminated that had no laps completed, well, typically, if cars are ranked, when more than one car goes out on the same lap, they are ranked according to who got to that position first. And in the event of no laps being completed because of being eliminated on the first lap, then they revert back to the starting field. And he didn't start 33rd, but he was the lowest starting of any of the people who were eliminated. Anyway, about him, rather than just 500 only, he was from Phoenix, as I mentioned, but he raced in California. There was a group called CRA, California Racing Association, which had started life as the California Roadster Association, and that produced Troy Ruttman, Jack McGrath, Manny Aiello, Don Freeland, and on and on and on. Pat Flaherty, Jim Rathman, Dick Rathman, Jimmy Davies, Andy Linden, all kinds of people came out of that group. And anyway, in 1956, by that time, they had switched from the California Roadster Association, which was track roadsters, hot rods, over to sprint cars, and it was now the California Racing Association. And in 1956, Art Bish was the champion. A driver named Joe DeHart was second, and Roger McCluskey, who had not been to the Speedway yet, was third. Art Bish drove some championship races in 56 and 57, but mostly west. I think it was just like Sacramento and Phoenix. I don't think he came to the Midwest until 58. Anyway, right after Indianapolis, of which he was 33rd with no laps, the very next race was Milwaukee, and he drove the Central Excavating Special up there. He qualified on the pole, and I don't know if he led the entire 100 laps, but he did win the race. So he was an unexpected winner of the 100-miler at Milwaukee, and then shortly after that was 100-mile race at Atlanta, Georgia, not at the track that's there now, but Lakewood Park, which was a one-mile dirt track, on the 4th of July, and he was fatally injured. He had a young son who grew up to look just like him, Art Bish Jr., and Art Bish Jr. actually ran in the Midwest with not a great deal of success, but he did run Champ Dirt cars or Silver Crown cars or whatever you want to call them for a while, and I haven't seen him in many years, but anyway, he was the spitting image of his father, and appreciate you asking the question, because I don't believe we've ever had a question on him before. And I love to talk about the lesser lights. I, too, some of the people that fascinated me the most were the ones that came here and with a record, with a career, and tried to make it and didn't, and either made incomplete attempts or got bumped or whatever. And certainly the fellows that came here and ran in the race once are of great interest to me. Anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call there, Mike.
And little known fact about that, Mike, you were caller number 9, so you actually won yourself a Hardee's racing watch for being the caller that day, right?
And a snack pack from Hickory Farms.
As long as it had some Stark and Wetzel golden ham, you were good to go, right?
That's exactly right.
We'll come back. We will continue taking a look at some of the one-and-done, one-hit wonders here on Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool, along with Racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Working on building a dream space, but don't know where to start? At the Home Depot, we can help you bring your dream project to life. Whether you're building a backyard oasis, a podcast studio, or
a wellness space. We've got everything you need, in-store and online. With project guides and free delivery options, it's easy to go from dreaming to doing. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens. Hire Hensley. Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons here on Beyond the Bricks, talking about one and done drivers, those that made one start in the Indianapolis 500 and for a variety of reasons did not make a return to the starting grid. Sam Posey is known well for his 1986 moment with Kevin Kogan at the end of the Indianapolis 500 when he radioed in. Kevin Kogan, of course, said, "I'm kind of busy, Sam," just before the last three laps that Bobby Rahal would win. But Posey also had a great finish in his one Indianapolis 500 as a driver. Here's Donald Davidson.
All right. Well, he did come back. It's just that 72 was the only race in which he drove. And I loved Sam Posey's commentary. And it was unfortunate that he would be browbeaten by one of the other people on the broadcast team. But I think that really that it was it would probably be more appropriate for quick observations. And Sam was extremely astute, but he probably was. It was more appropriate for an after dinner speaker, because when he would make an observation, it was sometimes very well thought out, and I thought very intelligent, and probably over the heads of some of the other people that were involved.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So anyway, as far as him coming to the speedway, he tried to run in 1969, and was turned down, and he was running the Formula 5000 series of that. Or was it the was it the Continental Series? Anyway, it was a road race series, and he was one of the more standout drivers. David Hobbs was also a contestant. A little bit later, then we had Brian Redman and Al and Mario running that series. Anyway, Sam was entered with Tassie Vatters in 1969, and he spent time at the track actually in April and then came back in May, and unfortunately he was turned down by the officials and asked to get more experience to come back. So he did that in 1970 and actually had an accident making a qualifying attempt. Then he came back in 71, and Jerry Grant owned his own car, an Eagle, but because he was driving for a Carroll Shelby team, Shelby Dowd, that Grant hired Sam Posey to drive for him. And in fact, it ended up that Jerry Grant qualified for Shelby Dowd and then sent Sam Posey out to qualify the Eagle while Jerry Grant was on the bubble. And instead of saving the car for himself, he decided, let's have Sam go. And Sam qualified 33rd, just bumping Jerry Grant. And then the next car to go out then bumped Sam. But I was really sorry about that, because I had one of the neat car names of all time, Farrell's Ice Cream Parlor Restaurant Special. I love those car names. Anyway, Sam in 72 got an Eagle, a brand new 72 Dan Gurney Eagle, just like Bobby Unser's, and he qualified 7th and then finished 5th in the race, and I'll come back to that. The last year, in 73, he qualified and was bumped, and there was an attempt to get a third car, a backup car, into the race, and there was a little bit of shenanigans went on, because it turns out they only had two, and the car that Sam had qualified and got bumped with was repainted and not terribly well, and Sam was a commercial artist and given credit for the paint job, which had he done his own known, it would have been a hell of a lot better than it was. Anyway, so it ended up that they disallowed that car to make a run, and Jimmy McAree drove the other one. Anyway, that was the end of Sam's appearances at the Indianapolis Speedway. But he was just, he's done a couple of books, and he's done a lot of commentary, you know, before the Formula One race. He's just a very, very articulate person, and very much of a historian, because it turns out that he was a Grand Prix enthusiast when he was like 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. And so we were able to have conversation about our heroes when you know, we were just barely in our teens. Anyway, Sam, when he finished fifth with that eagle, he told, oh, it's what a great name. It was Champ Car Racing. And it was actually Doug Champlin and Fred Carrillo. And they took the C-H-A-M-P from Champlin and the C-A-R-R from Carrillo to make Champ Car. But anyway, Sam said this to me. He said, we were just lucky that we ordered an Eagle from Dan Gurney, and that turned out to be the killer race car. And he said, we finished fifth. And this is a quote, as near as I can remember it. Anybody else could have won with that car. And I thought, how many other drivers would be that honest enough to make that statement? So I was always a huge Sam Posey fan, and I was rather saddened when he took abuse during his television commentary days.
In that aforementioned 1986 race, Kevin Kogan, of course, was trying to talk to Sam Posey. Randy Lanier was the Rookie of the Year, driving for the Arciero brothers. The next year, the team would again have a Rookie of the Year in Fabrizio Barbazza in 1987. Donald profiled him on Talk of Gasoline Alley 15 years ago.
Fabrizio Barbazza, love that name. And he did finish third and won Rookie of the Year in 87. And never ran another race. He did come back in 1992. In the meantime, he ran Formula One. He was a Benetton Formula One driver, but he did come back with Dennis McCormick, I believe it was, in 1992, and he made a qualifying attempt, but didn't make it. And then we never saw him again. And somebody sent me a photograph just recently. And I want to say that he's living in Cuba, but I don't know that that can be right. But he's basically a fisherman. Hmm. He does just offshore fisherman. I mean, sea fisherman rather than, you know, sitting by the lake. And I don't know if that's a permanent thing or what, but... anyway, it was a very interesting career at the Speedway.
Mike, it may have been the fun nature of saying his name, but Barbazza in just 1 year did have impact because he was a fan favorite his year at the Speedway.
Oh, there's no question about it. And Donald, at the time in that clip, he was talking about his fishing in Cuba. And he said, you know, I'm not sure if that's what he actually does as a job. That actually was up till a couple of years ago what Fabrizio Barbazza was doing as a job. He had some resorts in Cuba, and he was doing, you know, like charter fishing, and he would take you out on charters and things like that. And he had developed a couple of fishing resorts in Cuba. So Barbazza was always a popular driver at the Speedway.
Another popular driver 5 years before that was the 1982 Rookie of the Year. That's Jim Hickman, who unfortunately was fatally injured in Milwaukee after that 82 race. Donald Davidson on the brief career of Jim Hickman.
He was a sports car driver. He was one of the drivers that he was very quiet. And that's one of the toughest autographs to get, because he drove in the 500 in May and he was fatally injured at Milwaukee in August. And because he wasn't terribly well known, and I think once qualifying was over and prior to the race, I don't know that people really thought of him as being Rookie of the Year potentially, because he was up against Hector Rabaki and Danny Sullivan. And I'd have to think about some of the others. But so he was probably the least known guy in the field. And there was a lot of attrition.
And he was still running at the end, several laps down, but in seventh place. And I think he was probably as surprised as anybody to win the Rookie of the Year award. And as I say, he only ran like maybe three, four more races. And at Milwaukee in August, he had earned a position. He'd qualified. And then I think they had a practice session for the qualifiers. And that's where he had the accident and then succumbed. But he was from Georgia. And I'm trying to think of the name of the town. It was the Atlanta area. And I don't know that he was from there originally, but he was a car dealer. He was a sports car driver. And so he was fairly well off. Independent means, able to support himself in racing. And so he'd come up through several disciplines of like SCCA. I don't know if he ran IMSA or not. I really don't know much about his accomplishments, but in fact, it was really a bit of a jump, I think, for him to come to Indianapolis. And he drove for, and I'm not making this up, the Rattlesnake Racing Team, which was some fellows from Texas, I think. And but he did finish seventh, and I never met him. I met his wife. I remember a yellow dress that she was wearing, and as I say, we've got somebody in the room that would back up such things, that if you're trying to obtain autographs, oh golly, from all time, but even, you know, like within the last 35 years, Jim Hickman's going to be the toughest ones that you to find.
Another driver who could have been Rookie of the Year was the great road racing champion Al Holbert, who had his only start in a stacked rookie class in 1984.
As far as Indianapolis, that wouldn't take very long because he just had the one start and was very impressive. That was with the Morales brothers in 1984 with the CRC Chemical Special, and he finished fourth. In fact, he was awfully close to finishing second, and he's the son of Bob Holbert, who was a great sports car driver in the 50s and 60s, one of the Ford Cobra drivers. And Al actually retired and headed up the Porsche North America effort at Indianapolis in, they had come in at the end of 1987, and the program had a number of problems. He headed up the Porsche's entry into Indianapolis 500 and championship car racing, and they wanted Mario Andretti. And the car wasn't ready until the end of the 87 season, and so Mario was tied up, plus he wanted to see more. And they wanted to do everything themselves, so they built it was actually Messerschmitt built the original chassis, and they got Al Unser to drive it at Laguna Seca, and it only ran a few laps. And then they had one more race left, which was down in Miami, Tamiami Park, I think is what the place was called. And Al Unser said, no, thank you. And so Al Holbert actually came out to drive it himself. And they had huge fields in those days, and he actually missed the cut by three spots. And then it was a little later that year. Oh, then the next thing was that he hired Derek Walker away from Penske to be the team manager. And no sooner had that happened than he had his fatal accident. And it was just outside of Columbus, Ohio. There was a road race through the streets for, there was like an IMSA race for about 3 or 4 years or two mm-hmm. or 3 years, I think right. It was. And he lived in Warrington, Pennsylvania. And after the qualifications on Saturday, it was a Sunday race, and he decided to fly back to Warrington. And there was a problem on takeoff, a door opened. Mm. And he tried to shut the door, and then things went as Benny Parsons would say, they went bad wrong. Yeah. And so he went down. And then so then Derek Walker ended up as the head guy with the team, and Teo Fabi as the driver. In fact, they just named Fabi as driver when that accident happened. But anyway, Al Holbert just made that amazing run here in 1984, finished fourth, did not win Rookie of the Year, There were co-rookies of the year, and he was not one of the co-rookies because it was an amazing year with three rookies in the top five, and Roberto Guerrero was second, and Michael Andretti was fifth but had run second for a while, and so they split the balloting, and Al Holbert with fourth place would have been rookie of the year in just about every other year.
Yeah.
And didn't make it.
And Mike, unfortunately, Al Holbert would be fatally injured in a plane crash in 1988, not far from your home area.
That's right. He passed away in a plane crash that's not far from where I live now or where I lived a few years ago. And I actually was living in Toledo at that time. I drove down for the Columbus 500, which they used to have a race through the streets of downtown as an IMSA race. And that's what Al Holbert was in town for. And I got down here and to the race, and everybody was really sad, and there were the flags were all at half staff, and I was wondering what was going on, and I saw Derek Daly was doing a press conference about Al Holbert, and Derek was the one who actually told me that about the plane crash, and it was just a terrible shock when we lost Al Holbert in the plane crash at Don Scott.
When we come back, his first name is that of a beloved fictional character. His last name, that of a, depending on where you live, beloved and legendary basketball coach. But he is one of the one-and-done drivers. Can you guess who it is? We'll let you know when we return to Beyond the Brick.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool, along with Racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Working on building a dream space, but don't know where to start? At the Home Depot, we can help you bring your dream project to life. Whether you're building a backyard oasis, a podcast studio, or a wellness space. We've got everything you need, in-store and online. With project guides and free delivery options, it's easy to go from dreaming to doing. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Outside the box store and inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens. Hire Hensley. Tonight on Beyond the Bricks, we're talking about those drivers that made one start in their career at the Indianapolis 500-mile race. That includes a one-and-done driver from 1965 who had a great finish that year. Could have been rookie of the year if it wasn't for the greatest rookie class in history. Here's Donald Davidson on the very versatile career of Mickey Rupp.
Mickey Rupp was from Mansfield, Ohio, which is where Mid-Ohio is. And this is unusual. He sponsored a car in the 500 before he drove in it himself. In 1961... Don Davis from Phoenix, who was actually Ohio-born, but was listed Phoenix, Arizona as home. Don Davis drove the Dart Cart by Rupp Special, and that was Mickey Rupp's company. And when he drove a sprint car in USAC. Other than go-karts, I don't know that he did a lot of racing, but he did get a sprint car, which he ran in 1964. And he was helped by A.J. Watson, and there was a relationship, and I'm really not clear. I think that A.J. Watson and Mickey Rupp were cousins. Well, definitely, they were related somehow. Mickey Rupp's Indianapolis career was very brief as a driver. He was just there the 1 year, and he... was entered in a roadster. He drove one of the final roadsters, the Chapman Special, took his rookie test, and then had an opportunity to get into a rear engine car. So Eddie Johnson, who would come back in his later years without a car to drive, pick up something and then qualify it, went on to finish 10th. Mickey Rupp drove the Central Excavating Special, which on race day became the G.C. Murphy Store Special, because G.C. Murphy had sponsored a couple of cars that hadn't made it, and so the sponsorship was transferred over, and Mickey Rupp finished 6th in the Indianapolis 500. The next week, they went to Milwaukee, and he finished 5th, and then very shortly after that, he retired. Not only did he not finish the season, Milwaukee was his last race. Years later, 10 years later, he came back and ran very briefly with the Formula 5000 series. But that's really about it. He had a very short career and was legendary in go-kart racing when they would have major enduros. And so he was a participant and also a supplier.
804 drivers who are credited with a start at the Indianapolis 500-mile race. And again, that doesn't mean all of them took the green flag, but they qualified to start for the Indianapolis 500 race. And more than 250 of them, in fact, were one and done. They made one appearance, and we did not see them race at Indianapolis again. Fun tonight taking a look back at some of those. Ray Haroon, Lewis Strang, Alfred Moss, Al Hobert, as well, Mickey Rupp, who you just heard about, Fabrizio Barbazza, Jim Hickman, amongst all of those, and Harlan Fengler, Art Bish as well. For Mike Thompson, Landon Coons, I'm Jake Query. We're not one and done. We'll be back for another Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
And we're back in the Miller's yard. Despite the heat, their True Green lawn is thriving.
They got a lawn like a golf course here in Florida without wasting a weekend. And PGA Tour golfers started showing up.
Like this pro, amazed this grass looks this good in this heat.
Has to clear the trampoline and the kiddie pool.
Oh, perfectly struck.
True Green, the easiest way to get a golf course quality lawn. Click the screen now and get started today at TrueGreen.com. Exclusions apply. See TrueGreen.com for details.